Labor Radio is with Peter Julian, brand newly elected MP for Burnaby New Westminster. Peter Julian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shane. I'm glad to be here.
I'm very happy to have you here, and I just want to talk to you about the election and the fight that you won by. How many votes was that?
Just under 400 votes in all. It was quite an exciting election campaign. I was glad to be on Labor Radio just prior to the writs being dropped earlier in the year, and I'm glad to be back now to talk a bit more about it. But we could sense as the campaign wore on that there was a real shift in public support. I mean, in the last election in that same riding, within those boundaries, the NDP had received 16% of the vote, but we could sense that there was a lot more support out there, and particularly in the final week of the campaign, we got a real sense that we were going to be able to win the riding, because people were raising the kind of concerns that the NDP was responding to in the campaign.
That's very interesting. I thought that the NDP actually had a larger amount of support the previous elections in that riding boundary. So you say that they actually had 16%?
Yes, in Burnaby, New Westminster. And Burnaby, New Westminster is a new riding, and it was created out of portions of three ridings. The Conservative held New Westminster, Burnaby, Coquitlam, Sven Robinson's Burnaby, Douglas, and the Liberal held Vancouver South, Burnaby. So those three ridings each had chunks taken out of them and put together to form Burnaby New Westminster. And historically, it's been a very progressive area, but we were starting from a base in the 2000 election of 16%.
Well, it's incredible. The poll that you released just before the final election day happened showed that the NDP in your riding, you had a lead, and that the Conservatives were your biggest threat. Yet on the actual election day, it was actually Mary Pynenberg that was the biggest threat. How do you account for that?
That's a good point. I mean, the poll showed that we were in a close race, and we knew throughout the campaign that we were going to have to work on every street and make sure that we got the message out throughout the riding in order to win. I personally knocked on over 6,000 doors, and I think that was helpful as well, in addition to an incredibly dynamic campaign team. We had support from throughout the riding, about 400 volunteers who came forward to help out. So all of those elements helped. But you're right that the poll indicated that the Conservatives were neck and neck with us. But that poll was taken prior to Randy White's comments in the final days of the campaign. You'll recall that Randy White talked about the real Conservative agenda, and I think that scared people, and the Liberals ran a bit of a scare campaign as well, with their ads talking about the Liberals being the only party to stop the Conservatives. So it didn't surprise me in the final days that there was a bit of a Liberal bump. It's very important to note that we were on the doorstep throughout that weekend, and we were making phone calls throughout that weekend and letting people know that as an alternative to the Conservatives, in order to really send a clear message to Ottawa, they should vote NDP. And that's what many people in the riding decided to do, and that's why I was elected.
Do you think that Jack Layton's visit in the last few days of the election helped you at all?
I think Jack Layton helped throughout the campaign. He was there early on in the first week of the campaign, came to Burnaby to talk about the closure of St. Mary's Hospital. Clearly, health care was top of mind. People were very concerned because the closure of St. Mary's Hospital was symbolically a very important indication of to what extent Liberal health care cuts have impacted in our community. And I think that's a reason why a lot of people were very interested in learning more about the NDP health care platform. The fact that Jack came into the riding right at the beginning of the campaign certainly helped us. And his presence throughout the campaign, his great performance in the debates in both English and French were helpful. And then coming in the final days of the campaign as well, just to show again the importance that the NDP attached to the riding and to the issue of health care, all of those elements really contributed to help us win the riding.
Mm-hmm. What about the rest of Canada? It showed in the polls that the NDP were riding a high of about 20% during the campaign, And then when the ballots were counted, they came out just above 16%. Do you think that was a lot of the scaremongering by Paul Martin and the comments by the Liberals that caused you to drop in the polls?
I think that a lot of people were concerned about the Conservatives and forgot a bit about the Liberal broken promises in the final days of the campaign. I'll just give you one example, a couple of ridings in Saskatchewan where we had excellent members of Parliament for the NDP, Lauren Nystrom and Dick Proctor. They both saw in the final days of the campaign a shift of voters from the NDP to the Liberals because people thought they had to stop the Conservatives. What they actually ended up doing was electing a Conservative Member of Parliament, because by moving from the NDP to the Liberals, that allowed the Conservatives to come in and win those ridings. So I think people, a number of people were influenced by the Liberal ads. They were very concerned about the Conservatives, no doubt about that. But I don't think that trick will work again. We'll be in another election, given that it's minority government in the next year or two, one presumes. And I'm sure the Liberals will try the same trick. I'm not sure that it will work, because people see that, indeed, by shifting from voting NDP to voting Liberal, they were actually helping Stephen Harper's Conservatives. And the other thing, of course, is the Liberal broken promises. People wanted to send a clear message, and by shifting back to the Liberals because they thought it was the lesser of two evils between the Liberals and Conservatives, they weren't able to send as directly a message to the Liberals. Now, that being said, we're in a minority government. Very clearly, the population said that they want the NDP to play a central role in the new parliament. We now have 19 seats. There's a recount going on in Palliser, so presumably could move to 20. And that number of seats really gives us a balance of power in a parliament with the public that has said very clearly they want to have public health care, they want to have more funding to health care, they want to see a move back from this kind of corporate tax cut agenda that we've seen from the Liberals and certainly from the Conservatives over the last couple of decades. So I think, given that we have the first minority government now in a quarter century, this gives us a real opportunity to advocate on behalf of average Canadians and really move some important issues forward in a way that we may not necessarily have been able to do in a majority government with a smaller contingent in Ottawa.
It sounds like the NDP is still campaigning, that the campaigning didn't stop, that you just talked now that you think the government may last a year, maybe 2 years at the most. How much campaigning will the NDP be doing over the next little while?
Well, we're going to be working very hard, Shane, because we want to make sure that those additional voices that we now have in the parliament are heeded. And we want to eliminate this disconnect, reduce the disconnect that we see. Over the last decade under the Liberals, we've seen corporate tax cuts, we've seen unlimited expense accounts for Liberal appointees. And at the same time, we've seen the deterioration of our health care system, more private health care. We've seen increasing debt loads for students going into post-secondary education, increasing homelessness, increasing poverty, increasing debt loads for average Canadian families. I mean, there's been this huge disconnect between what the Liberals are doing in Ottawa and what is happening in our communities across the country. So I'm very invigorated by what I see around the table, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit later, the new NDP caucus, but the strength of the caucus and the energy that we have to actually go forward in this minority government and make a difference in Ottawa. So I'm quite excited by what I can see us doing over the next few months.
With respect to that next few months, how do you see the NDP as a role in Parliament when it comes to supporting the Liberals when they want to pass legislation? What influence do you think the NDP will have when they're one seat short of being the balance of power?
Well, definitely the Liberals are going to have to take us into consideration. They're going to do that. Now, whether they're going to admit to doing that is another issue. And publicly they've said that Paul Martin said he's going to govern as if he has a majority. Well, the last person who did that was Joe Clark, and his government didn't last very long in 1979. So I think Paul Martin shrewd enough to recognize that he's been sent a very clear message by the Canadian population. He's going to have to act in Parliament differently. So what does that mean for the NDP? That means that the NDP will be pushing forward progressive legislation that really deals with the issues that families across this country are dealing with. Some of the things I mentioned, education and health care, homelessness and poverty, the increasing issue of affordability for average families because of the fact that the average hourly wage has fallen over the past 10 years and the average debt load of families has increased. All of those issues are going to be important ones, and we will be pushing the Liberals to keep their promises and pushing them to do what's right for Canadians. That's what we'll be doing. Now, the Liberals will be approaching us for support, but they're going to have to contend with our objectives, which are to really make a difference, eliminate the disconnect in Ottawa, really make a difference for average Canadians because of all that we've seen, and rolling back this corporate agenda, the privatization agenda that we've seen in Victoria with Gordon Campbell and we've seen in Ottawa with Paul Martin. So if the Liberals keep their promises and if they govern in an effective way in dealing with all of these issues, I think we'll see NDP support for them on legislation. But if they try to govern as if they have a majority, they're going to experience a very strong opposition and a very vigorous opposition from what I see as a very strong NDP caucus.
It seems to me the Liberals are between a rock and a hard place. When it comes to privatization and tax cuts, that's part of their agenda. They've made that known. So they could get support, you know, by some of the conservative caucus, you know, with respect to those policies. And then on other issues like health care and education, they may come to the NDP in the Bloc for support on those issues. So they're playing a really fine game, it seems to me, trying to balance both sides against each other and trying to remain the Liberal Party at the same time to show voters what kind of party they are. If the Liberals try to look like NDP, the next time the writ is dropped, they may draw NDP voters away from them. So isn't it within the NDP's their ideology to try and make the Liberals look different than them?
Oh, we'll definitely be bringing forward our issues. There's no doubt that we'll be speaking very, very strongly and very vigorously to the issues that we believe need to be raised in Parliament. But I guess what I'm saying is if the Liberal Party, because of the NDP strength in Parliament, takes a clear position on public health care, for example, they'll receive NDP support for doing that. There's no doubt. But now we're going to be able to separate the promises from the reality. The Liberals have had real difficulty keeping promises over the past 10 years. Okay. They've just repeatedly broken them. Each time they go to an election campaign, they sound progressive. Right afterwards, they basically forget about those commitments and they go back to the corporate sector, and certainly they keep their commitments to corporate Canada. They don't keep their commitments to Canadians. And so we are there to make sure they keep their promises and that they do what's in the best interests of Canadians. If they start playing with the Conservatives, which is a very, very possible scenario, we're going to be opposing that very strongly. And I think what the Liberals will find as well is given their track record and the reluctance that many Canadians have to vote or support their agenda, it would be a mistake for them to either feel that they need to follow the Conservative line or govern as if they have a majority. They're going to have to make very prudent decisions. They're going to have to be effective in addressing really critical issues that are out there that Canadians are living through and experiencing. If they don't do that, the Parliament's not going to last very long, and we could be in another election very soon. If they do that, then we may well see a Parliament that was effective as addressing some of these issues as the one from 1972 to 1974 was, where we managed to see a host of fairly progressive legislation, including the fundamental shift in how we structure elections through the Elections Act, which made things much more democratic and basically provided for a leveler playing field. So 72 to 74 is a bit of a litmus test. It showed what a minority parliament can do. And in a sense, we're going to see over the next few months in what direction or what road Paul Martin chooses to take.
Okay, I guess I wasn't very clear. I was being very foggy when I asked that question. I was saying, wouldn't it be in the interest of the Liberals to try look like the NDP so that they can separate themselves from the Conservatives and get NDP votes so that the next time the writ is dropped, there's less NDP people in Parliament and there's more Liberals and they get that balance of power back and they form a majority? Wouldn't that seem to be their strategy? And if you follow that strategy and the NDP plays their game and falls and says, okay, we'll support you on this and that, and here, support healthcare and support these other values that the NDP supports, then they're just actually allowing the Liberals to take votes away from them. Do you see that at all?
I don't see the Liberals as being truly committed to the kinds of issues they talk about. So I understand your point. You're basically saying that the Liberals could pretend for a couple of years that they're progressive and actually enact the kinds of legislation that we've been talking about, fully funding healthcare, bringing in home care support, bringing in pharmacare, bringing in a child care program, which they repeatedly promised and always forgot after the election campaign, really address the issue of student debt, addressing the issue of homelessness and poverty. I don't think they will do that because I don't think they see those as real priorities. If they really saw them, if they were convinced that they were priorities that needed to be dealt with, then they would have governed differently over the last 10 years. But in many respects, they've caused those problems and issues and suffering that Canadians are living through. So I expect they may pay lip service to it. I don't expect that they are going to be as progressive as they like to pretend to be unless we're pushing them hard. And I think Canadians will see that the NDP caucus is pushing hard on those issues and forcing the Liberals to make more reasoned and effective decisions than they otherwise would. I mean, just some of the issues that will be coming up. We've got the ad agency scandal. We've got this for Liberal appointees, these unlimited expense accounts that has been part of the way that the Liberals have been rewarding their supporters. We've got all of those, the corporate tax cuts, all of these uses of Canadians' resources on the one hand. On the other hand, we've seen the underfunding. We've seen employment insurance or unemployment insurance, that fund being misused and for most people who are unemployed, the not having a safety net underneath them, healthcare cutbacks, post-secondary education debt, homelessness. So this will be a fundamental shift from the Liberals rewarding their own supporters and their own contributors to the Liberals doing things that are in the public interest. And I don't think that'll happen without us pushing and without us being very vocal. And as I say, I think Canadians will see that is a result of NDP pressure that these things are happening. So in short, I'm not worried about the scenario you lay out because I don't see it happening without our pressure in Parliament.
Okay, great. I'm going to switch gears a bit and ask you, not switch gears so much as go back to the election campaign and ask you about the Labour's role in the campaign. Was Labour a bigger role this time around due to the changes with Bill C-24 than they were the last time around? Were they very helpful with respect to your campaign?
Oh, Labour activists, undeniably. We had dozens and dozens of Labour activists come forward and work extremely hard throughout the campaign, there in the evenings, on the weekends, whenever they were available. And it's that volunteer support, that volunteer strength that really made the difference. So I think it's fair to say a different type of campaign with the changes in the Elections Act and the changes on how a campaign can be structured. What was critical for our success, because we don't have the financial resources that the other parties have, is having a lot of committed, dedicated, energetic volunteers and people from the labor movement, labor activists, came out in great numbers and were extremely dedicated and hardworking throughout the campaign. And that was a very important foundation for our success.
With Bill C-24, the NDP now gets $7 for each vote cast in your favor. How much of that money goes back into your actual riding association for them to fund your next election campaign?
It's a good question. It's $7 over 4 years, So it's $1.75 a year. And I expect there'll be some discussions on that at federal council in the fall, because at this point it's not clear what will happen. Those funds go to the National Party. The National Party is going to put together an election strategy, and that will include development and organizational support, as happens with all parties, in the pre-writ period, in the pre-election period. So it'll be interesting to see over the next few months what the strategic decisions are on how those funds are going to be used. I, from what I understand, the party ran a very effective campaign. We have a small debt to pay off, but basically, over the next few months, once that debt is paid off, we can continue the organizing work that's important to preparing the next election. So it'll be interesting to see what decisions are made to see how those funds are allocated.
So if there's an election in 1 or 2 years, you only get $1.75?
It's $1.75 per vote per year. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I think there were nearly or just over 2 million Canadians that voted for the NDP in this election. That's certainly up the strongest support we've had in over 15 years of federal elections. So doing the math, that would give us somewhere between $3.5 and $4 million a year in public funding. And I support the idea of public funding. I don't like to see what we're seeing in the United States, where there is almost unlimited funding. It's quite mind-boggling, the millions and millions of dollars that is poured into election campaigns, basically to support candidates who are supporting the interests of their contributors. And seeing Michael Moore's recent film, There's a quote, as I'm sure you've seen, with George Bush, where he says, I'm glad to be here tonight with the haves and the have-mores. This is a big fundraiser with millionaires that have come out to see George Bush. And then he says, some people call you the elite. I call you my base. Well, that is exactly why George Bush has been able to govern the way he has. He receives his funding from the wealthiest of Americans and has provided tax cuts and all kinds of subsidies to the wealthiest of Americans. And the middle class in the United States and poor Americans are suffering as they haven't from since the New Deal and the Great Depression in the 1930s. So that type of private money going in to influence the political system, I disagree with fundamentally. And that's why I support the idea of public funding based on the support that people get, that political parties get, because that means that the public determines who gets that funding. And that's important for consistency and having the kind of level playing field that allows us really to have interesting and important public policy discussions in an election campaign and between elections, because all parties are starting from the same standpoint and all parties are able to contribute depending on their level of public support.
Yeah, I think that's excellent as well. I agree completely with what you just said there. On the topic of the Elections Act, the NDP also supports the changing the first-past-the-post system to a more proportional-type representation system. What are the chances that we could get some referendum on this in the next election cycle?
It's a good question, and I think proportional representation is a good, effective way of addressing the democratic deficit. And Paul Martin's paid a lot of lip service to the democratic deficit. We saw during the campaign that he parachuted a bunch of non-elected candidates into Greater Vancouver, so we saw how committed he is to addressing that. But if we'd been working in a proportional representation system, the NDP would have gotten between 40 and 50 seats nationwide. So obviously we're underrepresented in Parliament given the strength of our popular vote. Conservatives and Liberals are overrepresented. So proportional representation would help to start to address that. the fact that a party like the NDP is underrepresented is important because we represent the 2 million Canadians, as I mentioned. But also, a proportional representation helps to address historic underrepresentation by groups such as women, for example. Proportional representation allows for more representation across the board, allows political parties to choose their candidates in a way to address representation issues, so visible minorities. Women candidates tend to be more prominent because political parties can work through a system or put in place a structure that allows for greater representation from all groups within society. So those are all advantages of it. Now, the question of how we're certainly going to fight on this issue, we'll have to see how far we get. Sometimes there are entrenched interests at work, and we may find we come up against opposition from the Liberals and Conservatives because they like being overrepresented in comparison to the vote that they actually receive. But the reality is there's more and more discussion on this issue. A number of provinces are looking at the possibility of bringing in proportional representation, and it's inevitable in my mind that at some point in the near future we'll be moving towards proportional representation because it makes sense. It provides for more effective representation, and it also allows us to really address the issue of votes counting. It means that a vote counts wherever it's cast in the country for whatever candidate, even if that it may be a candidate for a party that hasn't been strong in that particular region, that vote still counts and in the overall total. So I think it's an issue that will continue to be on the forefront in the coming years.
We were just talking the last half an hour about the election and the campaign. Let's talk about your campaign office. Have you been out looking for a campaign office at this point in time?
Yes, we're actually looking at a number of constituency offices that we'll be setting up to service the needs of the citizens of the community. One thing I found very interesting is that we won the election on Monday night, and early Tuesday morning, we were receiving our first calls on casework. I mean, there are issues that citizens of this community need help with. So we were right out front and center, and I've basically been responding to calls and making sure that people are aware that we can assist them. It will be a lot easier once we get the constituency office up and running, and that should happen in the next week or two.
So have you found a location yet?
We have a couple of locations we're looking into, and we're looking really into the central part of the riding. That's either Edmonds down to Kingsway or 12th Street in New Westminster. So in a fairly limited number of blocks, we're looking for a campaign or a constituency office that will allow us to really provide good service in a central location that's easily accessible.
Okay, that's great. I also was looking on the internet and saw that you're now assigned a portfolio with the NDP. Now you're the International Trade and Globalization Critic, the Persons with Disabilities Critic, and the Treasury Board Critic. Have you been briefed on any of those areas yet?
I'm currently talking with the former critics from our previous caucus, so I'm getting up to speed with Bill Blakey, who is the International Trade Critic, and Bev Desjarlais from Manitoba, who is the Treasury Board Critic, and Wendy Lill, who's the former Member of Parliament from Dartmouth, and she was the critic for people with disabilities. So each of them are helping out in bringing me up to speed, but I should say I have experience in all three areas, and I think that's why Jack Layton, who had a really difficult task in looking around the table and allocating a shadow cabinet or critic portfolios, I think Jack did a lot of work to make sure that people got critic areas that they were well suited for and had experience in. In my case, I worked as National Executive Director for the Council of Canadians and did a lot of international trade-related work there. when I lived in Ottawa and worked for the council. My current position, or just prior to the election, was executive director for the Western Institute for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing. So I've been involved in disability issues, both in the deaf and hard of hearing community. And as you may know, Burnaby is really the center for the deaf community in the province of British Columbia. We have two deaf schools, the BC School for the Deaf and Victory Hill Residential School. So we have a couple of deaf schools and a vibrant deaf community. So I've had a lot of work and a lot of experience working with the deaf and community, but also working with hard of hearing individuals, those who are blind, and the BC Paraplegic Association, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, etc. So I think that's why I was given the honor to be given the critic portfolio of people with disabilities. And that brings the third one, the Treasury Board, which is equally important given some of the decisions that are going to be made both in public sector negotiations over the next few months, but also in terms of looking at Treasury Board guidelines that seem to favor Liberal appointees rather than providing a sort of consistent guideline to everybody involved in public service. And my background as a financial administrator, I think, is what led Jack Layton to appoint me to that portfolio for the Treasury Board. So I have some experience in each of the three areas, and I'm going to be relying on our former critics to bring me up to speed, but I feel comfortable in each of those areas. And I think I'd say the same right across the spectrum. The critic portfolios that members of our caucus were given are portfolios that suit them. For example, if we look at British Columbia, we have Bill Sixay, a partner in Burnaby, as the Member of Parliament for Burnaby Douglas. So we share Burnaby as our community, and he is handling citizenship and immigration. And he has a lot of experience having worked with Sven Robinson as his constituency assistant in those areas. But he also has the Western Economic Diversification Portfolio and Canadian Human Rights. And then we look at Libby Davies, who is our House leader. She'll be playing an extremely important role in this next Parliament. And Nathan Cullen, who's responsible for environment and youth. He's the Member of Parliament for Skeena-Bulkley Valley. And, of course, offshore oil and gas is going to be an important issue in this next Parliament. And he's led opposition to that in the North Coast. And then Jean Crowder in Nanaimo-Cowichan. And Jean is responsible for women's issues and natural resources. And, of course, given the resource component of her community and her long experience, she'll be equally great in that area. So I think when I look at the five BC MPs, we're all playing an important role. And I think that's also a sign that Jack Layton is putting a lot of importance in British Columbia for this Parliament, but also for the election that will come in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it does appear that the BC caucus has quite a lot of responsibilities, that's for sure. And it looks like you're going to be getting your feet wet pretty soon, especially with the Public Service Alliance of Canada getting close to being in a legal strike position, which means that
100,000
federal public service workers may be hitting the bricks sometime in September. What is the NDP's position with respect to the Public Service Alliance of Canada and their strike position?
Well, we want to make sure that the federal government negotiates in good faith a collective agreement that will cover those employees. So I think it's fair to say, though I'm still being brought up to speed on the file, it's what's happened so far is there have been offers that are really not serious. And I think it would be really tragic if those public sector workers were forced to go out on strike when, if the government just negotiated in good faith, we'd be able to get a good agreement and provide for that ongoing public service that's so important for our country.
Another issue that the federal employees are engaged in right now and is in the media quite glaringly is the whistleblower protection that the public servants have been asking for. Some PIPS people were fired because they had disagreed with Health Canada in allowing some drugs to be available on the market. So what's the NDP's position with respect to the whistleblower protection?
We want to see it because it's absolutely important for protecting the public interest that whistleblowers be protected. And it's shameful what's happened in the last few days with the firing of those three very well-respected Health Canada scientists. It really, really is tragic. And here again, I think this is the worry that when we look at a minority parliament, Paul Martin has two choices. One is to work and really heed what the public has told him on June 28th in the election. The other is to pretend that he's in a majority government situation like Joe Clark did and just forge ahead. And the firings, I think, may indicate that Paul Martin, at least initially, will take this idea that he's really has a majority and can just forge ahead, and in effect, backtrack on a solemn commitment that he undertook during the campaign and previous to it. He talked about whistleblower legislation. That died on the order paper, and the first chance they get, the Liberals seem to want to fire these very dedicated scientists that have terrific reputations, and their only fault is that they basically blew the cover around what was happening for approval through Health Canada. So I hope that we can reverse that, and I strongly believe that whistleblower legislation is sorely needed now, more than ever before, to protect public servants and others who are legitimately coming forward and saying this is wrong what is happening, whether that's corruption or approval of medication or foods that should not be approved. It's important that we have that protection for public servants and others.
Excellent. Thanks, Peter. Just on the international trade and globalization portfolio you have, the Free Trade of the Americas Agreement is being negotiated. It's somewhat of a slow process, but it's still in negotiations. Have you been briefed on that? And what is the NDP's position with respect to the FTAA?
Well, our concern with trade agreements generally is some of the provisions that have been brought in. We saw this with NAFTA, with Chapter 11 and the investor state provisions, which basically protect investors to the detriment of what's in the public interest. We've seen with Chapter 11, we've got corporations that have been suing governments for public policy decisions that are in the public's interests, but because it impacts on the profits or the potential profits of these investors, they can sue and get millions of dollars from Canadian taxpayers. That was wrong to put that in NAFTA. It's something that is being pushed in areas like the GATS through the WTO, the General Agreement on Trade in Services, and with the FTAA, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. This idea that investors should have more rights than the public, than individuals and citizens. So this is the completely wrong road to take. And this is one of the fundamental aspects when we talk about international trade that needs to be changed. We're talking a lot about investors' rights. We're talking a lot about corporate rights. We're not talking about individual rights, citizens' rights, the right to social programs, the right to labor legislation, the right to protection from unsafe workplaces. So the whole aspect of trade needs to be really turned around so that rather than talking about preserving profits for a very few within any trade agreement, we're talking about bringing the standard of living and the quality of life up for the many. And so I think this is going to be a bone of contention when we talk about trade, when we talk about FTAA. It's a problem. The Liberals don't get it. They don't get it that corporate rights and investors' rights should not predominate over the rights of publicly elected, democratically elected city councils, for example, or provincial governments to take measures that protect the public, protect the citizens from environmental damage or from neurotoxins. The example that's often given is Ethel Corporation suing and receiving $19 million from Canadian taxpayers when a neurotoxin that had known harmful effects on people was banned. I mean, this is the bizarre aspect of international trade that we really need to change.
Thanks, Peter. You know, I think you're going to do a wonderful job in Parliament for the people of Burnaby, New Westminster, and the people of Canada. You sound very knowledgeable and very, strong in your commitments and what you believe in. And I think that's going to be great for the people around here. And I appreciate you coming on to this show and talking to the people in Burnaby, New Westminster, and the greater Vancouver area about the issues that are important to us. And I invite you back some other time when some new issue hits the floor and we need to have a talk about that too.
Oh, I'd like that. I'd very much like to come back, and thank you for inviting me today.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Shane.
You've been listening to Peter Julian on Labour Radio. I'm Shane Polak.